You're listening to West Texas Talk, your daily interview show here on KRTS and KXWT. There's a new book out. It's really more like an atlas. It's called the Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People. It's a collection of maps and essays, and it explores conservation and ecology all across the state: land, water, energy, built environment. Joining us today is David Todd. He is the founder of the Conservation History Association of Texas, and he's one of the authors of the book. David, thank you for joining us.
Travis, thank you very much for having me on.
So one of the things I'm curious about to start is, where did this book come from? Like, what was your personal interest in doing a book of this scope?
Well, that's a good question, and I guess a good answer would go back a number of years, to 1997. I was practicing as a environmental lawyer, and one of my mentors grew ill, and I thought I should capture his memories, and did an oral history with him, and then proceeded to do about 230 more of them, and that was under the rubric of the Texas Legacy Project, and we made a book with Texas A&M Press based on those interviews with a variety of environmentalists around the state, some ranchers and farmers and fishing guides and game wardens and politicians, a real gamut. And we published the book through Texas A&M Press, and our editor, after we came out with the book in 2010, a book called Texas Legacy Project, Stories of Courage and Conservation, she asked if we wanted to do some sort of a sequel. And I think kind of as a lark, without thinking real carefully about it, I suggested, well, would you be interested in an atlas about environmental history in the state? And she said yes. So that was kind of the start of it. And I think, like the original book, the Texas Legacy Project, that oral history volume, this new book, Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People, it's an effort to tell these stories about protecting land and water and wildlife and energy resources, public health in the state, maybe using a different, more accessible way of explaining things. You know, in the first case, you know, sort of spoken word, people's stories of their own lives and experiences. And then with this most recent book, using maps and charts and big data as another way, maybe a visual and geographic way, to get people in tune with what we're trying to explain.
Yeah, so what do you think that that maps can do that maybe nonfiction or just like a more narrative form can't?
That's a good question. My co-author, Jonathan Ogren, who's a geographer and map maker extraordinaire, he likes to say that we are visual creatures, and I have seen some interesting numbers on that, and that some people have said that 90% of the information that's bouncing around in our human brains is visual, and then in fact we process those signals much faster than text, something like 60,000 times faster than text. So we're really good at looking at maps and other visual images and understanding them almost intuitively, almost instinctively, very quickly. And so I think in that case, maps can often tell stories that narratives may struggle to tell.
Hmm. And then, well, I guess kind of getting back to why you wanted to do it, did you see like a void out there in terms of books that touch on all this?
Well, I think that mapping is going through a very long sort of process. And if you look at maps that were drawn in the 1500s of the United States or even the 16, 17, 1800s, they're very rough. You know, they're a little crude, and there are lots of areas that are marked terra incognita, you know, unknown lands. Mm-hmm. And so I think that every generation, every year perhaps, you know, we get a better and better understanding of the world around us and how to map it and chart it and plot it and really understand it. And that's become especially true, I think, in the last 10 years or so, where a lot of geographic information that's been digitized, that's in a form that's, you know, can be stored on hard drives and on the internet is now available from academic sources and state and federal agencies and nonprofits and individuals. And so it's very easy now to put together these maps where you used to have to do them longhand, and or else go out in the field and, you know, use all the transits and, you know, the mapping gear of yesteryear. So that's probably the reason why I thought that there might be an opportunity here for the Atlas to fill a if not a void, at least a gap that might be useful.
Sure. I read a quote by this geographer and cartographer named Dennis Wood. He says something interesting about maps, which is that maps make arguments, you know, like X is over here and Y is over there and like A and B are related. And so if you accept the basic assumption that maps do or at least can make arguments, what do you think that this book, a collection of some 300 maps, what kind of arguments do its maps make?
Well, I think, you know, in a sense, we're trying to describe the Texas world. And in that sense, it's pretty objective, and we probably aren't at least consciously making an argument. You know, we're just trying to document, you know, conditions on the land and in the water and energy resources and wildlife and so on. But just like statistics can lie, maps can emphasize certain things more than others. Sure. And so I think we were probably as guilty of that as anybody, that we did try to present something of an argument with these maps. And I think that there are several kind of arguments that we were maybe most interested in. First of all, we wanted to say that conservation, you know, whether it's of water resources or habitat or wildlife, is a long effort. You know, it's something that has started many, many years ago. And I'll give you an example. You know, there's a fellow named Charlie Goodnight who lived up in the Palo Duro Canyons, and he was a famous Texas ranger and rancher and an early pioneer of the cattle trails. And he was also, starting in the 1870s, one of the first people to try to protect the bison that had been almost eradicated in the western United States. And of course, that effort really has continued for two and three generations now. And now there are 350,000 bison out there in the world. And so that is a process that we've tried to sort of chart in the book that's over 140 years. And so I think that's one argument that we were trying to make in the book. Another is that every corner of Texas has a conservation issue and concern that people in that part of the world have been working on for many years. You know, we've got chapters that are about the protection of the playas up in the high plains of the Panhandle, and we've got maps and chapters about the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle down along the coast and the brown pelican also along the coast. We talk about the reservoirs out in the Big Bend that were proposed and very narrowly averted. So I think that's another argument we wanted to make, is that if you have an interest in sustainability and the future and what sort of Texas we'll see in down the road, there are many local things that you can get involved in. And then the last argument I think we might make is that a lot of this data and a lot of these efforts are from individual volunteers. These aren't efforts that have come from up on high. They're really projects of people who want to do something as a hobby or on their weekends, and they're self-taught and they're unpaid, and they're just, in my book, totally admirable for, you know, committing that kind of effort to these protection efforts.
We're out here in West Texas, and I'm curious if we could talk a little bit about some of the examples from your book that take place out here in West Texas. And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So one of the ones I'm thinking about is there's a series of maps about the red imported fire ant. In it, you talk about, tells a story about how it kind of came to the U.S. and some of the consequences and silver linings of that story. So do you mind kind of outlining the story of the red imported fire ant?
Yes, I'd be glad to give it a try. So the elevator version of this, I guess, 80-year history is that the red imported fire ant probably came ashore in the United States from South America on some sort of freighter or banana boat that docked in Mobile, Alabama, sometime in the 1930s. And it hit the ground running. It spread out from there. Within 20 years, it had made it all the way from Mobile to Orange, Texas. And from, I guess, the late 50s, where it maybe occupied, I'd say, about six counties in the state, it spread to cover, they estimate, 112 million acres and 190-odd counties across the state. It moved, once it hit Texas, some 500 miles in 55 years. And you think that this creature is maybe an eighth of an inch long,
yeah,
maybe less than that. That's extraordinary, you know, so impressive little creature. And it's, you know, we maybe take a message home from that is that these invasive creatures and species that are not native and that have sort of outcompeted the native creatures have to be respected for their sheer resourcefulness. But then on the other hand, the damage that they've done to game birds such as quail or a lot of nesting songbirds, even deer, you know, is also something to worry about aside from being respected. And I guess another message we might sort of take from the fire ant spread and our response to it is that we used numerous chemicals, cyanide and chlordane and heptachlor and dieldrin, and they really had very little impact. But there's increasing research that suggests that it may have been one of the reasons the fire ant spread so far and so fast is that it did a lot of damage to the native ants. Hmm. So I think there's an irony there that, you know, there can be a lot of unforeseen consequences from our good efforts to try to manage the land and, you know, manage the environment in a way that, that suits us.
Well, you're listening to West Texas Talk, your daily interview show here on KRTS and KXWT. Our guest today is David Todd. He is the founder of the Conservation History Association of Texas, and he's one of the authors of a new book called The Texas Landscape Project, which explores conservation and ecology across every corner of the state. It's chock full of photos and deeply researched essays and some 300 maps, and in that way is more of an atlas than your typical nonfiction book. So, David, there's another example in this book about, it's called The Poo Poo Choo Choo. Do you mind telling me the story about that and how Texas ended up with a bunch of feces from New York City?
Well, you know, I guess there's a segue here, like when they go from the sports to the weather on the news program. I think both the story of the fire ant and of the sewage waste from New York, they both sort of tell the story of how there can be a lot of unexpected ramifications from things that happen in one part of our environment that ripple out to other parts of our world. And the story of the New York poop train, as they sometimes call it as well, goes back to the mid-1920s, where the city of New York started barging its wastewater sludge from its sewage treatment plant, I guess about 10, 12 miles offshore into international waters and dumping it. And that worked for some 60 years or so. But then a lot of unmentionables started rolling up on the shores of New Jersey and New York. And by 1987, the federal government had outlawed dumping sludge offshore. And of course, that left beachgoers happy, but it left the waste managers in New York City sort of scratching their heads. And so they decided, well, we're going to hire a company, which they did, called Merco, to find a home for our sludge. And they approached Oklahoma, They asked folks in Arizona, and they were resoundingly rebuffed and told that, no, we did not want New York City sludge in Oklahoma or Arizona. But then they came to a place called Mile High Ranch, which is some 80,000-acre tract near Sierra Blanca out in West Texas. Many of you probably know of it. And by 1992, they were shipping some 400 tons of sewage waste out there on a 2,000-mile trip from New York City out to West Texas. And, you know, it went from one of the great metropolises of the Western world to a tiny little, you know, impoverished Hispanic town. And so, it, you know, there were concerns about air violations and groundwater threats and public health risks. But I think there was also just this sort of David and Goliath feeling that, you know, New York City was foisting its environmental problems on a community that really didn't have the financial and political wherewithal to rebuff it. So I think that's, you know, the gist of the story. Of course, by 1997, New York decided it was too expensive and probably also too politically hot. And so, you know, they turned to other ways of disposing their waste. But that's the story of the poo-poo choo-choo. And I think, again, it just gives us sort of a message that, you know, there are ramifications that, you know, sometimes we don't really expect.
Yeah, so kind of like ecological and, you know, social ramifications maybe.
Both, yes. Uh-huh.
So this book, clearly there's a lot of there's a lot of maps, there's a lot of data, and it just seems like something that must have been an enormous research undertaking. I'm curious if you can kind of walk through, maybe with the fire ants as kind of an example, how you go from idea to research and where you get it to kind of the final product that you see in the book.
Well, you end up going down a lot of blind alleys and dead ends, I got to admit. And, you know, there were maybe another, there are 40 chapters in the book, and there are probably as many that are on the cutting room floor. But some of these stories, you know, the story of the fire ant spread, fortunately did have a source of data that was a nice fit. And that data was that one of the ways that the state governments that fire ants visited and also the federal government, they both tried to institute quarantines where you were not allowed to ship horticultural materials outside of counties that were infected with fire ants. And people kept lists of these quarantine counties starting the 1950s and through the present day. And so if you have a list of those quarantine counties, you know where the fire ants are. And it may not be a complete and up-to-date list because the fire ants may not have been discovered in other counties, but it's a way to see where they're acknowledged to be. And so we were able to put together a series, sort of like a cartoon of a series of maps that would show where those ants were being quarantined in 1955, 1960, 1965, 1970, and so on. And you can see these fire ants radiating out from Mobile, Alabama. It's an amazing sight. And it's, I think, one example of how you can, you know, use some of these sort of odd data sources that were not intended to track fire ant movement, but serve the purpose.
Sure. So kind of along that line, in the course of all this research, what stood out as most surprising? I'm sure you had some crazy realizations along the way.
Well, I think one is that, you know, I think many of us, especially if we get older and get to be my advanced age, you start to think of your childhood is somewhat idyllic. You know, it's sort of an Edenic world where things were easier and better, and the grass was greener. But I've really been struck, since the scope of this book really reaches back, and for one map, it goes back to settlements along the Lake Amistad that were flooded by that the damming of that reservoir. It goes back 9,000 years. And so this atlas has a very long stretch of time that tries to describe, and it's been a reminder that in many ways we live in a better world today than we did in years past in terms of the environment. Hmm. People are much more conscious of impacts and of trying to mitigate the kind of effects that we might have that would damage the environment. And, you know, you think back, as we were talking about before, Charlie Goodnight, 140 years ago, we were basically eradicating bison as a piece of military policy to try to undercut the Native American populations in the West. And that certainly isn't the case now. Similarly, in the 1890s to the 1910s, really all the East Texas forests were cut to the ground. It was clear cut. And while, you know, those forests are still managed pretty extensively for trees and wood, there's much more care done in how those forests were managed. Similarly, you know, you go back to the 1930s, and a lot of land that was farmed really heavily in the panhandle, as soon as the weather changed, we had these terrible dust storms. And, you know, nowadays with no-till agriculture, that's much less likely. Hmm. And so I think that one thing I took away from researching the book was that we're getting smarter and we're getting more careful and we're getting more thoughtful about what kind of world we're leaving for our children and grandchildren, which I think is a really heartening thing.
Sure. Well, you've been listening to West Texas Talk on KRTS and KXWT. We're out of time for today, but we hope you'll join us next time. Our guest today was David Todd. He is the founder of the Conservation History Association of Texas and one of the authors of a new book called The Texas Landscape Project, a collection of maps and essays that explore conservation and ecology across the state. Mr. Todd, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Really, a treat. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.